It's very good to be here, and I'll have a go at answering the question. Actually, I'm not going to have a go at answering the question, how could a good God allow evil? I'm actually going to explain to you why it's a very bad question. But I'll come to that in due course. In the meantime, I live down in New Jersey near Princeton, so it's kind of ivies float around in my head in a way. But a man in Princeton asks his way to Harvard. "If I were you," he's told, "I wouldn't start from here. Of course, hand mighty Harvard people might, for all I know, take a dim view of starting any journey from Princeton, least of all a journey to Harvard. For Harvard is the centre of the universe, and sensible journeys start from there. But if Princeton is where you are, you don't have any choice. And so it is with many problems, particularly of a philosophical sort, among which you might think is the question I have to address today. How could a good God allow evil? On the other hand, I can see how it is thought that the question is in order as a starting point, because while for a reasonable person, thoughts of evil in our world may well cause doubt as to the existence of God, no one can reasonably doubt the existence of that evil. Hence, it looks as if evil is a problem for belief in God, in a way that belief in God can never so convincingly explain or so less justify the world's evil. In the late 18th century, David Hume put it that way around, in what is perhaps the classical statement of the so-called problem of evil. It's been pretty much where everyone has started since. "Is God willing to prevent evil," he asks, "but not able? Then he is impotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Whence then does evil exist?" For my part, I don't agree that you have to start there with Hume. In fact, I think you oughtn't to, as by the end of this talk, I hope you'll see. And just so you know ahead of the game, what I want to try out on you today, here's where my talk is headed. First, I won't attempt to answer the question of my title, not at any rate directly, and this is because, as I say, I think it's the wrong question. We shouldn't start from here, because we cannot know the answer to that question one way or the other. Secondly, I want to try and explain to you why it is that today we find it almost impossible not to start from Hume's question, and so we still put the question his way round. And we might think it reasonable to do so, because if you're unfortunate enough to be in Princeton, where the evil is, you have no alternative but to start from there, and not from Harvard, where, of course, all is well. Since Hume, then, the philosophical and more generally the cultural boot has been on the atheist foot. So naturally today we set out on the journey with his foot forward. This, I think, though understandable, is wrong. We don't have to start with Hume, nor should we. Well, that's the case I shall put to you and then ask you what you think of it. Now, when I say that we ought to not to start with the problem of evil so presented, that is by Hume, because in that form it's a false problem, I do want you to be clear as to what I mean. There is a problem of evil, but not all evil is a problem. Some of it we can take in our stride, there being no cause for philosophical or even moral alarm therein. So we should start by taking the existence of such evils out of the debate. For example, you may have different feelings than I do about the matter, but I personally never have had a theological problem with lions eating antelopes, though I can't help feeling sorry for the panicking beasts as they flee their predators in such wonderfully graceful leaps and bounds. Nor do I find myself distressed that lions seem as unlikely as ever to get round to lying down with lambs, as Isaiah had hoped they would. For lions lying down with lambs would, of course, be good news for lambs, but it would be terrible news for lions. It goes with being lions that they eat lambs. A lamb-eating machine is more or less what a lion is. And more generally, there seems to be a rule here. in that nature seems to require a level of raw indifference in matters of tooth and claw. That is, if you want the variety and complexity of the natural world at all, and so want there to be lions, alas, lambs are going to have to pay for them with their lives. "Did he who made the lamb make thee?" asks William Blake of The Tiger Burning Bright. The question is rhetorical, and the answer is yes, he did. And if you have a problem with that, consider what alternative world you have in mind that doesn't replace a problem for lambs being eaten with a problem for carnivorous predators being starved for want of ovine nutrition. The same, I guess, with the inanimate physical processes, but they sometimes impact, unhappily, even tragically, upon human affairs. In the mid-18th century, an earthquake in Portugal kills 30,000, and Voltaire loses faith in God. Vastly more understandable would have been his loss of faith in human beings. It was they, after all, who built Lisbon on a fault line and seemed willing to blame anyone or thing but their ignorance for the destructive outcome. We today have far less excuse for continuing to build a San Francisco on the San Andreas Fault. There seems to be something of a pre-modern and merely pagan superstition in supposing that there would be a problem about God if someday, soon, San Francisco were to disappear forever down an immense sinkhole. For we do know now that in due course it's going to. If you ask more generally why a good God who had alternatives available to him, would create a world in which earthquakes are bound to happen, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that, or that anyone does. I'm rather inclined to think that in asking that sort of question about earthquakes, you're asking about sets of physical processes, the laws governing which originate at some point in time in the order of -43 seconds after Big Bang. That is, if you think God ought to have created an earthquake-free world and regrettably didn't, then you're sure to be regretting too much. You'd almost certainly have to regret all the physical laws that govern the universe itself. You can't pick and choose the good bits out of physics, less the bad, but that isn't physics at all. For obviously, if God makes a world in which there are going to be predictable outcomes, that would be because God wants us to be able to understand it. But the world would become wholly incomprehensible to us if we could never know when physical laws are going to be suspended by God just to suit our particular preferences from time to time. There are those physical laws precisely so that, by getting to know them, we can learn to avoid building cities where earthquakes are predictably going to happen. More challenging for some is the problem of pain, physical pain, that is. Hume, again, takes the lead here. He seems to think it obvious that a world in which no one suffers physical pain would be a better world than the one that we have got. And he asks why, if God is good, he should have chosen an alternative, so obviously the worst of the two. It seems plainly possible, he says, to carry on the business of life without any pain. End of quote. Hume's sceptical musings are rarely so thoughtless as when he speculates in this way. And there's a quick and sharp answer to it, forthcoming from anyone suffering from that rare genetic disorder known as CIPA, the chronic inability to feel pain. Hume might be less convincing on the advantages of a pain-free life had he given a moment's thought to the tragedy of a life threatened by scaldings in overheated bathwater that you can't feel, the prospect of limbs broken of which you are unaware, a broken glass that you have walked on in bare feet without noticing, or of a hand held in a flame that there is no painful sensation to tell you of your limb's destruction, then you might not be so easily convinced that bodily pain is an altogether bad thing, and you will hardly think you are better off taken in the round for want of it. To which Hume, as if acknowledging that some pain has its purpose in animal life, concedes the general principle that perhaps some pain is necessary, but presses the point, why so much pain, he asks? Why unbearable pain? Would not tolerable pain, or even some reduction in pleasure, serve the purpose of sending out the signals needed to warn of life-threatening courses of action, no purpose being served by intolerable pains? To which I guess there's some sort of answer in the thought that pain cannot serve its purpose within the economy of human life if it occurs only at tolerable levels of mild discomfort. For when tolerable, pain loses its point. Pain doesn't do its job if it is less than too much. Neither does a simple reduction in one sort of pleasure relative to others. After all, a cup of so-called English tea, in this place, commonly emptied into the harbour in revulsion, has its pleasures of a sort that English people appreciate, if not Americans. Tea is not a painful drink just because it appears significantly to lack the thrills of Colombian coffee or of a fine red wine. That, by the way, doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to reduce the levels of pain that visit us. Of course we should, but only so far as it is safe to do so. And a world in which analgesics were used to dull all pain to acceptable levels of discomfort would be a world in which, our bodies no longer serving with biological efficiency to warn us, we would have endlessly to calculate how to avoid physically harmful behaviours. Pain makes for an immensely more efficient warning device than sluggish brain power and its turgid capacity for self-deception. None of these forms of evil, if indeed that is what they are, have any tendency to pose a problem of the kind that Hume thinks we're all forced to face. You can guarantee safety for lambs only on condition of wimpishly vegetarian tigers and lions. You can have an earthquake-free cosmos only on condition that there are no physical laws to govern it. You can have a world free of physical pain only if it's a world free of physical pleasure. In short, only if this is a world without nervous systems, and that is to say, without bodies. Given the kind of world that we have, these pains are necessary evils where they're not just necessary goods, in which case it's hard to see why the existence of such pains is to be regarded as providing rational evidence against God. On the contrary, if anything, they seem to be more like arguments supportive of a providential benevolence within creation. Of course, you don't need to bring God into the picture at this level at all. For myself, I don't think one should, since evolution will do as a perfectly good explanation for the emergence of the species that we've got, for the lions as for the lambs, and as to why all animals have nervous systems that register the pain with an intensity that they do. But if, like the non-evolutionary Hume, and in consort with fundamentalist Christians of our time, you insist on bringing God into it at all, the evidence from the natural world points pretty decisively against his atheist conclusion, not in favour of it. Ours seems to be just the sort of natural world you might expect a good and wise God would bring about if God was going to bring about any world at all. But as for moral evil, for what we might call sin, if our sensitivities are not so preciously refined as to prevent us calling it so, that would seem to be a very different proposition. Here at least we think you have to start in Princeton. That is, with where we are and should not be. For there really is a problem, and Hume half gets there, if only in a sort of ironical toss-away remark to dismiss it. Is God both able and willing to prevent sin, he asks, and then rhetorically, whence then is evil? He doesn't really take this option at all seriously, for Hume cannot conceive of the possibility that a world we have, in which there is so much sin, might be exactly what an omnipotent and holy good God should have willed. And I want you to consider that there's a serious problem here, a problem more serious and difficult for believers than Hume himself envisages. Whence then is evil is a real question for Christian believers, not one to be swept aside with an ironical gesture. Not being satisfied with Hume then, I want to take a step away from him and his 18th century rationalist priorities. Priorities so assumed as to make it easy for him to derive an atheist conclusion from the grim facts of evil. Easy, because for Hume, atheism solves the problem by eliminating it. All you need do is to take God out of the picture and the tension is resolved. Evil becomes just par for the course, and that is for him a better solution than the only alternative is a certainly false one, which safeguards the existence of God by taking evil altogether out of the picture. And in moving away from Hume, I want to draw your attention to a surprisingly different time, place and style of reflection on the problem of evil. That of an author who shares only one thing with Hume, and that is a sense of bafflement, how the existence of a good and omnipotent God could be compatible with the existence of sin. That author is, surprisingly, a 14th century woman, an anchoress named Julian, who lived a life of seclusion, vowed to remain for her lifetime walled up in a cell attached to the parish church of St. Julian in the suburb of an East Anglian city of Norwich. A person unlikely, you might think, to challenge effectively the worldly, urbane Scottish sceptic, to outbid him equally for greater moral realism as for greater conceptual sophistication. For on both scores, she is vastly the more complex and nuanced of the two. Why is there sin, she asks? How can there be sin at all? Since she is assured in her showings of divine love, as she calls them, that God himself does not see sin, that insofar as we are overwhelmed by a sense of sin's presence in ourselves and all around us, we fail to see our world as God sees it. For famously, in that world, she is assured that all will be well, and all will be well, and every manner of thing will be well. End quote. Now, if you're a 21st century philosopher in the Christian tradition, you will probably think it's just eccentric to ask, why sin? And it is worth noting why her question seems so important to her and so odd to the philosophers and theologians of our times. But the assumption equally widespread among both philosophers and theologians today is that the one thing of which you don't need an explanation is that sin does happen and that it's bound to. It's just obvious, is it not, that if you create a world of free agents, where freedom must at least allow for the choice between good and evil actions, then necessarily some evil choices are going to be made. Nor is that necessarily a hyperbolic statement of a merely very strong likelihood, for it is a view almost universally maintained among philosophers today that although a world of completely free agents, none of whom ever chose evil actions, is certainly describable, by strict logical necessity, such a world is uncreatable, even by an almighty God. For were God to cause such a world to exist, then God's causing there to be no sinful choices in it would thereby rob those innocent choices of their freedom, it being assumed that no action can be free if anything other than I is the cause of it. And if that anything other, and that anything other, includes even God. A world without sin, then, though describable, is therefore uncreatable. Necessarily, then, there is sin because God cannot create a world guaranteed to be without it. And Julian's question, why sin, is redundant. Thus, for example, the Calvinist philosopher recently retired from Notre Dame, Alvin Plantinga. But Julian insists God could have created a world of human beings so that no one freely chose to sin. In fact, there's a vast spiritual as well as intellectual chasm between Plantinga, who evidently thinks that a human will could be free only if it occupies the space evacuated of the divine agency, and the medieval anchoress for whom, as for Augustine and Aquinas, our free choices are precisely where the presence of God's agency is most evidently and directly working. The work of that agency they call grace. Of course, it is because of this view of hers that God is the cause of our free choices that Julian thinks there's a real question why God did not create a world of free agents who choose not to sin. He could have done so. We should, I think, give serious thought to Julian's doubt here. One of the reasons why Julian ought to be a much tougher theological read than the cheerful and empty-headed goody-two-shoes she is often represented as being today, is that contemporary readers fail to advert to how far she is from pursuing the escape route out of the problem of sin available in Plantinga's conventional account. Julian would have been much puzzled by this ploy. Indeed, she would be much troubled by a view of how the divine causality stands to free human choices, according to which they are mutually exclusive. For Plantinga, if I did it freely, then it could not have been the case that God was the cause of my doing it. For Julian, as again for Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, to think like Plantinga of God's causality as standing to my free action, as excluding it, in the sort of way in which your jogging my elbow would exclude my spilling the teas having been done freely, this is fundamentally, indeed idolatrously, to misrepresent the nature of the divine causality. But that is to think of the divine governance as if it was some sort of super creaturely agency interfering in the world from outside it and competing with it, a semi-pagan deity jogging the world's elbow at will, rather than the total cause creating it out of nothing, and so as being more within the world's agency than any creaturely cause can possibly be. And as a free human agency, God's causality is, as Augustine put it, interior intimo meo, more within me than even I am. It's in causing my free actions that God's presence and activity is most, not least, evident. In fact, at one point, Julian goes so far as to say that he, God, is, I quote, the only doer, end of quote. So unlike Plantinga, Julian sees no problem of consistency in maintaining that God could have created a world of free but sinless human beings. But just because of that, she has to face a problem that can't arise for Plantinga. If God could have created a world without sin, should he not have done so, she asks, since such a world would have been the best possible world? And would you not suppose that a perfectly good and all-powerful God would, as a matter of course, make such and only such a world? At this point, Julian is fully engaged in a sort of dialogical argument with the Lord about the matter, chapters 27 to 32 of her long text, read like a sort of conversational disputed question in the academic mode of the medieval university. And it's a subtle one, requiring a lot of the sort of careful reading that it doesn't always get in the secondary literature of our times. For sure, the Lord rebukes Julian for her anxieties about sin, but not notice for having been wrong in supposing that God could have created a world of free human agents who did not sin. Julian, of course, is far from thinking, like the German rationalist philosopher of the 18th century, Leibniz, that this world, full of sin as it is the best possible world. In fact, sensibly enough, she seems to think that as of worlds, nothing could answer to the description best possible, any more than there could be a sonnet or a string quartet that answered to the description best possible sonnet or string quartet. Of course, there is the view, in paraphrase, it is Leibniz's, that there must be a best possible string quartet. It would be the string quartet that God would compose if God were to compose one. In fact, obviously, even God cannot be under any constraint to compose only the best possible string quartet, even if there were such a thing. Because if God can compose only the best possible string quartet, then there's only one string quartet that God can compose. And that means that there's something that Beethoven can do that God cannot do. For while Beethoven could compose his C-sharp minor string quartet, opus 131, he did, it would follow on this account that God could not have composed it, because obviously the C-sharp minor string quartet is not the best possible string quartet. There's at least a possibly better one on the cards, even perhaps a better one that Beethoven himself could have composed had he lived. But as with string quartets, so with worlds. Like Thomas Aquinas, Julian does not think this is the best possible world. Like any medieval Christian believer, she thinks the world is possible in which, like ours, everybody is totally free, and unlike ours, no one can want to sin anymore. And it's being so, it's exactly as God has omnipotently willed it, since God has created exactly that state of affairs in creating the heaven that is off to us after death. There, we are guaranteed for all eternity to be utterly sinless and totally free. So it's not on account of her being at odds with Plantinga that Julian is rebuked, because the Lord evidently agrees with Julian rather than with Plantinga on the score of possible sinless world of free agents. Rather, she is rebuked for her having supposed that all manner of things would be well only in such a sinless world. What Julian is told that in this world, in which there's all the sin that there is, with all its sharp pain, as she calls it, nothing is amiss. And that in just that world, sin is, well, sin is what exactly? Behoverbill, says the earlier Sloane text in the now redundant Middle English word. Behovely, says the later Paris manuscript. And I mentioned Plantinga just now for a very particular reason, having to do with the mistranslation of those words into modern English that is to be found in the older Penguin modernisation of the long text by Clifton Walters. And more alarmingly, even in the more scholarly College and Walsh modernized version, sin is necessary, is how all three have it. Necessarily, then, in a world of free agents, there will be sin. So Walters, so College and Walsh. That, however, is Plantinga. It is not Julie. Now, why is it so egregiously wrong to translate behovely as necessary in the way Walters, College and Walsh do on lexical grounds, as Plantinga would require as a matter of logic? The reason why necessary is so wrong is that its translation of behovely involves a gross misunderstanding of the nature of the theological predicament that Julian feels constrained to address. For as we've seen, necessary is exactly what Julian thinks sin isn't. That's why she has the problem Plantinga hasn't got, believing that things could have been otherwise. That's why she cannot go along with Plantinga's solution or anything like it. She needs to take an entirely different theological tack. Necessary is a term forming a joint in a linear inferential, that is to say, a logical sequence. If this is the case, then necessarily that follows. And that way of understanding sin as being necessary is fine if you think that there could not be a creatable world without sin, because then you have a philosophical solution to the problem of evil. Evil is necessary in any world that God can actually create. God can't help but that there is sin. But Julian thinks that there is no solution by such means, and her approach to the problem evokes a quite different vocabulary of explanation. Just as the logician's if-then has a formal constructive character within the inferentially linear, so Julian's behovely has a formal constructive character in relation to the quite distinct literary structure of the narratival. In short, behovely is the connective tissue of narrative, not of logical sequences, of a storyline, not of a syllogism. As a rough translation into modern English, Julian's behovely means something like fitting or befitting, implying that there's something that the behovely fits with and gets its sense from, or perhaps appropriate, which likewise needs a context within which it has a well-judged narratival presence. Or, as I would have it, sin's behovely means sin is just so. On the other hand, I have to say that if you want to get closest to the medieval meaning of behovely, easily the best translation is not into modern English at all, but is rather a medieval Latin term of theological art, namely conveniens. One way of getting a grip on the non-logical character of that term is from the standard medieval question about the incarnation, whether the incarnation was necessary, to which the standard answer from the time of Anselm's treatise, known as Why Did God Become Man, standard answer was twofold. No, the incarnation, absolutely speaking, was not necessary. God, after all, was under no necessity of nature nor obligation in justice to do anything at all about the sinful predicament of creatures. And if he were to do anything about it, many other possibilities of relieving that predicament were available to God than the incarnation. And, what is more, all of them at much lower cost. So, as Duns Scotus was to put it earlier in the 14th century, God became man not as a reaction to an event unanticipated, not at any rate principally as a solution to any problem, because Scotus thought that even had Adam not fallen, God just fancied the idea of becoming man regardless. As the book of Proverbs put it, it was wisdom's, I quote, delight to play with the children of men, end quote. On the other hand, neither was the incarnation a merely contingent whim on the part of God to send his son into the world to preach, suffer and die for the world's sake. If neither under any necessity to do so, nor in doing so merely whimsically indulging in his power to do it, then the question of why God chose to set in train just those events, historically particular as they were and are, needs to be understood otherwise than in terms of logical or natural necessity. We need instead a vocabulary of answers to the question, why did that happen, that is closer to that in which one answers for an event within a particular narrative of events, because one is explaining how the narrative makes sense of just that happening. Well, as to the incarnation, the term of art after Anselm, the medieval theologians used in answering the question, why did God become man, was that it was convenience. What was done was done, the medieval theologians said, because it was convenient. It was not that it just so happened, as if by accident or on a whim, nor was it a sort of plan B, things having gone so terribly wrong with plan A in the Garden of Eden. But if neither was it a necessity imposed upon God, it was indeed just right that God did it. It was convenient, behovely, just the thing, a godlike thing to do. And you can get to see how right it was if you can get the hang of the story it fits within. In short, convenience in Latin, or behovely in Middle English, are terms descriptive not of how logical and linear, but rather of how narratival and spiral sequences are formed. It's a term descriptive of what is just right about a good story. So the vocabulary of the convenience, or the behovely, is that of connective tissue, not as extruded by means of the formal inference, but of the spiral, which accumulates meanings as it goes along, and as it accumulates those meanings, progressively demands the readjustment of the narrative curve. And that brings in all sorts of matters needing explanation, of which the first is this. Whereas logic, dealing in inferential sequences, must abstract the general from the particular, narratives are always particular, individuated. You can tell that logic doesn't need a particular, because it is, or can be, formalised algebraically. You don't need particular values for the variables to get the formulae of logic going. They hold for each and every substitution of P and Q. But behovely doesn't work that way. If, as Julian believes, sin can be seen to be behovely, this can only be because there's some narrative of everything whatever, because the sum total of things adds up to a story, to just this story, of this sequence of events, including those sins whose place within the narrative is fitting, just so. For there's just one narrative of everything whatever. There's just one sum total of events that is human history. What has happened this way and not that, though it might have happened otherwise. And what is going to happen this way rather than that, though it might have been going to happen otherwise. And what is behovely is what fits within just that particular narrative of just this world, which is the way it is, because it's been created to be like that by a perfect love. And for Julian, just as it is for Duns Scotus, Thomas Aquinas, and perhaps especially for Dante, just this world is therefore a sort of commedia. Now I think that this means that for Julian, the way to think about the world we inhabit and the history we have made is in respect of this comedic character of singularity, very much as one does about a work of art, about something unique. And Julian's notion of what fits, of what is behovely, is in consequence more of an aesthetic than of a logical kind. It's perhaps easiest to see this in music, but its arrow of time is, like that of a narrative, unidirectional. A friend of mine, to whom I'd been waxing on about Mozart, complained that Mozart's music is just too predictable. This is exactly wrong. Otherwise than as to a few standardised cadences, which are sort of musical throat clearing, everything in Mozart's music is supremely unpredictable. But also, everything in Mozart's music is supremely retrodictable. So transparently retrodictable as to create the illusion post factum of utter predictability and obviousness. When a cadence or a modulation is completed in an unexpected way, you're both surprised and know immediately why it had to be just so, and how it's being just so reveals in you everything that precedes it. Stories and music, perhaps especially music of the classical period, in the end make the surprising turn of the events be so obvious, as if after the event we can see how we might have predicted it, even though before the event in no wise could we have done so. Now, you could say that thus far what I've put to you would provide a sort of understanding of Julian's theology, were we considering but her description of the incarnation itself as behovely. For her, the coming of Christ could not have been anticipated had it not been prophesied. We'd have had to be told that that was what was on the cards, because no necessity entailed it, whether on the side of divine or human justice. But when the incarnation happens, everything becomes clear. We have a hermeneutic of the old law, obscure poetry that seemed to mean one thing becomes a hermeneutical key for everything. Think of how differently the prophecies of Isaiah read when post factum you read them in the light of the incarnation. And to be honest, I think everything would be fine and dandy about Julian's theology had she merely been proposing the medieval commonplace that the incarnation was in this way behovely. But the problem is that that's not all that she says. What Julian says is behovely is sin. How now about Julian, the cheerful, upbeat, goody-two-shoes? The problem of credibility that Julian's theology presents us with deserves to be faced squarely. Here we have a great theologian of the Christian Church telling us that sin is behovely. She tells us this not because she's cheerfully naive about the world's evil. After all, she lives in what must be, after our own, quite the nastiest century in recorded Western history, the 14th. But because knowing the world's evil for what it is, she believes that it follows from core Christian beliefs about the divine power and love, that sin so fits with the divine plan that nothing can be truly amiss. And this can seem implausible, even scandalously so. For we must suppose Julian's theology to entail saying that behovely, and so not amiss, was the bureaucratic cold efficiency with which the murder of 6 million Jews was planned and executed. Behovely, the ideologically motivated mass exterminations of the Pol Pot regime. Behovely, the frenzied pogroms of Rwanda and the mass rapes of Syria. Behovely, the betrayals of every adulterous spouse. Behovely, every lie told in breach of trust. Behovely, every sexual abuse of a child. Behovely, every rich person's denial of food to the hungry. That's our cuddly, comforting, cosy Julian, for whom apparently nothing is amiss. I have to admit that at this point in the argument, it is all too easy for the contemporary theologian to lose his or her nerve. Frankly, that's my problem with the free will defence of Plantinga and others. You take Plantinga's line in order not to be stuck with Julian's, and because you feel weighed down by the heavy burden of human evil. Just say, sin can't be helped, it wouldn't be sin if it were not free, and our sinning would not be free if God had prevented it, so you can't blame God for sin. It's all our fault and none of it down to God. So that's all right then, since the only way in which there could be a human world without sin would on this account be a world that in truth was without humans. For a sinless world is impossible given freedom, and there are no humans without it. But for Julian, this isn't all right. Significantly, Julian's position is closer to that of most atheists of our times than it is with that of most contemporary Christian theologians. Here, for example, is Plantinga again. I quote, "It was beyond the power of God himself to create a world containing moral good, but no moral evil." End of quote. Julian disagrees. Then here's John Mackey, an atheist precisely on account of believing Julian to be right and Plantinga wrong. I quote, "God was not faced with the choice between making innocent automata and making beings who, in acting freely, would sometimes go wrong. It was open to God the obviously better possibility of making beings who would act freely but always go right. Clearly, God's failure to avail himself of this possibility is inconsistent with his being both omnipotent and wholly good." End of quote. And here's Julian, 14th century anchoress, sorely tempted to agree with Mackey. I quote, "And I thought that if sin had never existed, we should all have been pure and like himself, as God made us. And so, in my folly, I had often wondered before now why, in his great foreseeing wisdom, God had not prevented the beginning of sin. For then, I thought, all would have been well." End of quote. What is clear, then, is that, to put it all in a completely anachronistic terms, Julian would rather have Mackey's problem, with or without a solution, than Plantinga's solution, the price of which would have to be paid in the currency of what a later age called deism, the doctrine of a god whose presence is expelled from that part of her creation that is most in his image and likeness, our freedom of choice. That conclusion Julian cannot tolerate, and in truth there is no solution in Plantinga's deism that differs in any significant way from Hume's atheism. So, does Julian have a solution? I'm not sure that she does. For certain, she knows that there is one, For, I quote again, all manner of things will be well. And what is more, she knows what alone would count as a solution. A lot depends on how we're to understand her when at the very end of her second attempt at the problem, in the work that we know of as her long text, when that is, after perhaps many more than 20 years of turning the problem of sin over and around, this way and that, she tells us that though this book was begun by God's gift and his grace, even then, in the very last chapter, she is still saying, this book is not yet finished as I see it. Clearly, among the things Julian does not mean by not yet finished is that the text is unfinished. On the contrary, the statement that a book is incomplete is clearly intended as the appropriate and responsible conclusion to as carefully constructed a theological treatise as I know of in the 14th century. Nor does she mean that, though some theological progress has been made in the long text that she had not been able to make in her earlier, much shorter version, perhaps a third stab at it might yield a text that is finally complete, a text that once and for all answered the question, why sin? In that sense that Milton, John Milton, seemed to think was required of a theologically satisfactory response, and is able, as he thinks his Paradise Lost is able, to, I quote, justify the ways of God to men, end of quote. In none of these senses does Julian mean that the long text is not yet finished. But as I say, as text, it is undoubtedly complete. And as to Milton, well, no, not complete in his sense either, theologically that is, for on her account of it, no such justification of God's ways is possible even in principle. So in not providing one, Julian's text does not, as to her sight, fail of completeness. In what sense, then, and in relation to what conception of completeness, is the long text not yet complete? It's the not yet that matters here. That not yet is Julian's theological refusal of both forms of theological completeness. On the one hand, the linear completeness of the philosophical Plantinga, which would purport to demonstrate the formal consistency of an infinite love's creating just a sinful world. And on the other, though no more acceptable, is the completeness of the poetical Milton, who would purport to out-narrate the problem of sin by completing the story that justifies the ways of God to men. For all her doubts about how it could be true, Julian accepts that sin is behovely. But I think that Julian knows enough about how the logic of the behovely works, narratively, to know that we could see how sin could be behovely only were we in possession of the complete narrative that makes sense of it. And that we're not. All we possess is but a narrative fragment, a torn-off corner of the manuscript of salvation history, and it tells Julian of nothing but the paradox of an innocent man judicially executed for a reason he too begs to know of, though he dies, as we will too, the reason why being denied him. Somehow Julian knows, though what she knows is that she does not know how, the meaning of sin, its character to be holy, lies in that incomplete narrative of the cross that is at the heart of her showings, a narrative whose incompleteness is necessary, but not yet belongs to the nature of human existence in time. Julian then cannot complete her book, for incompleteness is in the nature of the narrative spiral itself. It's not just sins being behovely that are being told by that narrative, it is we, she, who are being told by it, including her two attempts to grapple with that narrative fragment that is shown to her. In that fragment is the meaning, but it is hidden from her. Julian knows that her attempts to lay hold of the complete story are themselves but episodes that occur within it. Or, as the postmodernist art of our times would have it, she is being read by the narratives she believes herself to be reading. She is being told by the narrative she twice attempts to tell. What would answer to Julian's question, why sin, is the narrative completed, the book finished. And that it cannot be in history in time. For completed narrative is literally end of story, and that, Julian knows, is the beatific vision, the price of which is, of course, death. In the meantime, then, there is but the meantime, the not yet. And Julian does her theology. She twice writes her revelation of love, and she lives the life of an anchoress, all of these obedient to that condition of incompleteness, obedient to a condition in which neither understanding nor living can yet be completed. Julian is the theologian she is because she knows that theology is writing as penultimate. For writing that is pretentiously finished is not theological. It is parody. It is Jeremy Bentham's nonsense upon stilts, the ridiculous parading as the sublime. Julian's theology is truly spiral. It begins and ends where unending begins. And maybe, after all, T.S. Eliot's In Four Quartets did get it right, at any rate as to Julian. For her, too, it is in her end that is her beginning. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Okay. Yeah.
Towards the beginning, you mentioned that, of course, we should try and reduce pain as long as we don't go too far. I was wondering if you could talk more about that and where you think too far is.
Yeah. I really don't know. I mean, I think there would be a point in which, I mean, just imagine that we were able to eliminate all pain. We would have serious problems. I think once we've got the warning that you've got cancer from the pain in your chest, you don't really need much after that. So there is a lot to be said for palliative care, attempting to control the pain. But you wouldn't know, I mean, if the lack of pain meant you never went to a doctor to get a diagnosis, then you'd be in serious trouble. You would die just quickly without knowing why, you just die. So I don't know, there's no sort of obvious answer to that, except that I think the people who are engaged in palliative care know about what the answers are likely to be. It's a practice, I think, rather than something you can put your finger on and sort of say, well, here's, take the extreme case, eliminate pain altogether, you have really big problems. Do nothing about pain, you have really big problems. There's somewhere in between. So I think that means you actually appreciate pain for the good it does, but don't allow it to become the tragedy that it can become. Do you see what I mean? So I think that's why, you see, it doesn't seem to me that there's a problem about God here, it's just a problem about care. Do you see what I mean?
To go back to the
I missed that. Go back to...
Go back to the musical metaphor. It seems that if you reach the end of the piece and you go back and you say that everything in the piece was unholy, how can we trust that... So if Mozart is God, then Mozart, is an infinitely better composer than we would be. So how are we to trust that he's provided us that there are no easier, no beholden paths less dissonance or less dissonance?
I don't know if this is addressing your question, but I mean, I was just kind of thinking that moving away from the idea that if God created this world, it must be the best possible world, is a bit like saying that there's a standard of musical perfection and this piece of Mozart meets it or doesn't. No, I mean, as it were, the perfection is contained within the practice itself, within the work itself, do you see what I mean? And that might seem like a sort of circular kind of thing, but only if you're thinking that there must be some kind of musical perfection and this meets the conditions for it. I think it's internal to the particular piece of music. I mean, what happens in the last movement of the Jupiter Symphony is an amazing set of canonical variations, weaving in and out of each other in an amazing sort of way. Now, what's perfect about that is that it works perfectly. Now, the it is very particular. It's that last movement, which has those particular... It's not the best possible last movement. It doesn't have the best possible thematic material. It makes no sense to think in those terms. So I think this sort of anxiety about whether whether there's something really wrong with our world because it isn't as perfect as it could be. Look, any of us that can think of a way in which this world could be better. I mean, there was a terrible murder in Lincolnshire the other day. This world would not be all that different if that murder didn't happen, but it would have been a better world. Certainly a better world. Now, if you've got a problem about that, you know, just in principle, and I think this is where Hume gets it wrong, there's always going to be something wrong with any world. You know? And I think what Plantinga is sort of working with is that he's generalising it to a point where the only way in which you can say you could justify the world that you've got is by removing God's agency from our freedom. Now, that's really, I think, the problem here. And Julian won't go down that line. So I think two things in relation, I hope, to what you're putting there. One is, let's drop best possible world talk, because it isn't helpful at all, and that's why I think pieces of music, works of art, novels, whatever, you know, they're not the best possible novels. It makes no sense. No literary criticism could work with such a concept. But you can see why. Hard Times is a better novel than David Copperfield, or whatever you want to say. I mean, I don't think that's it all, but let's say Middlemarch is a better novel than anything Dickens wrote. But and you could still use the language of evaluation. It's still available to you. I can still, as I've just done, I can describe to you how this world which we've got would be a better world easily by removing the tedium of having to listen to Turner lecturing. That would be a better or whatever, you know, it's just like that. But we just have to sort of drop that kind of talk. Otherwise, the problem of evil becomes absolutely impossible to deal with. Yeah. And it's just that, you know, that what's going on there is a kind of false standardization, which actually doesn't make any sense. That's why I think one has to think less in terms of the problem in logic, which is the way Hume puts it. It's a question of consistency between a series of propositions. Actually, one has to move from that into an understanding of how things work, which is closer to that in which, the way in which one understands a piece of music or a novel or a poem, something like that. It's much more like that. Does that sort of address what you're talking about? Yeah.
So one possible objection to that line of reasoning is that what we see as fitting is a cultural kind of something. You know, I mean, I read this study recently that showed that what people can think of as good music is culturally dependent. Like, you know, people kind of hypothesize, discordant music is actually unpleasant to people universally. But they actually did some studies with some tribes out where they had discordant music, and they just thought that's perfectly fine. It's, you know, crying was universally considered to be unpleasant, but that makes sense because, you know, it's a human response. But
there are musical variations, but we can translate. I mean, Japanese pianists could be better than European pianists playing European music. And so on. I mean, having cultural variation doesn't mean that there can be no exchange between the variables. Well,
sorry, that's not what I meant. What I meant was that, I mean, it's true for any particular culture, but there's some sense of, you know, I mean, I guess the question, I very like much like this idea of fitness, but the question is, how do we not be deceived in some sense by our sense of what's fitting? Like, we say, oh, that fits because whatever, but maybe, you know, in a world that's broken, people think, oh, what fits, you know, the right thing is this broken thing, and in fact, what we need to be is cured of our brokenness in order to actually see the right fittingness.
I thought I was really going along with sort of what you're saying there, there is a contextual business here that you can't work with absolutes, which sort of supervene across the historical, that we don't have the best possible world because there's no such concept available to us as a standard of comparison for our world. You can always tinker about with our judgment about this world and say, well, as I just said, one could easily imagine a world, this world, not a different world, but this world, being a better world than it actually is. I mean, after all, that's what we do, and that's our agency within it. All Julian is saying is, look, whatever about the incompleteness of that, whatever about the contingency of that, whatever about the possibility of describing the world as being better, there is within it a perfect love operating,
And we can't see how that is so, nor could we. It would be impossible for us to do so. So in a way, she's saying, there is a sort of ultimacy about her judgment that all manner of things will be well, but it's still contextual within a world which is not itself utterly perfect. Now, I think writing those two together is the name of her game. So not playing off the cultural variations, as it were, as against the notion of the Behobelius being operable, or only operable contingently within particularity, because I think that's precisely what she's saying. That you don't have to suppose we've got a perfect world for the notion of Behobelius to operate. So one could well imagine, one could even think through the possibility of a different world being more Behobelius.